If you enjoy our hymn studies, be sure to check out the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, Praise and Honor, Hymn-Inspired Devotions. Praise and Honor contains a devotional for each stanza from hymns like God's Own Child, I Gladly Say It, Rock of Ages, Cleft for Me, We Praise and Acknowledge You, O God, and more. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Praise and Honor, Hymn-Inspired Devotions. Your child is ready for high school. He or she is excited about it. You're a little worried because you're going to send your child to public school and you don't know if they're going to get the best education there. But you've been assured by the administration, maybe even by the President of the United States, that these curricula are going to be overhauled and worked over and improved with something called Common Core, especially English and math, those two very, very important skills, and that your child, when they get done with 4 years of college, will be more ready than the students before them to enter college and go on and have a career. 4 years later, do the numbers bear out that promise of the education administration, of all of the bureaucrats that see to the education of your children, and maybe even the President of the United States? Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're going to talk about the first Common Core high school graduates. Joy Pullman joins us. She's managing editor of The Federalist, author of the book The Education Invasion, and a recent column titled First Common Core High School Grads Worst Prepared for College in 15 Years. Joy, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, thanks for having me.
In its own words, the top stated goal of Common Core was to increase American kids' college and career readiness. Has that goal been met?
Not according to all the data that we are seeing since Common Core went into place. So Common Core was this big national program to get all of the states to have their tests and their curriculum in English and math line up across the nation. This was supposed to President Obama, his education secretary, Arne Duncan, and not just Democrats, but also Republicans like Jeb Bush and a number of Bill Bennett, Reagan's former education secretary, was a proponent of Common Core. All of them told the nation that, you know, this was going to move American kids ahead in their academic achievement, where we've been stagnant for decades, basically ever since we've been measuring almost. And none of that has happened. So the latest data that we have comes from a report from ACT, which is one of the two big testing, college preparation testing companies, the other one being the SAT. And there's another one called the Classical Learning Test, which is a new competitor. Anyway, but ACT put out a report saying that this year's high school class of 2019 were the worst prepared for college that they had seen in the past 15 years.
So give us an example, if you would, of how Common Core approached a subject that has probably very predictably led to our children being less prepared for their careers and for college.
Well, one of the fundamental flaws of Common Core is really by it's the same, you know, actually that's faced by any, almost even public institution, particularly public schools, by they really, in order to get so many people to buy into the idea of Common Core, they had to basically make it palatable to every single possible constituency and interest group, which meant that there is no way that what Common Core turned out being could possibly be of high quality, you know, because different people have different, very strong opinions and opposing opinions about what comprises high quality in education, all kinds of things. So, for example, you know, one of the things that your listeners might be familiar with is the reading wars. That basically boils down to phonics versus making kids memorize every single word individually as if English were Chinese. All the research and the experience really clearly indicates that, you know, straightforward phonics teaching is the most effective for all kids. But because of ideological differences, there are people who don't think that it's not interesting, that it doesn't get the kids' attention, that it doesn't engage them enough. And so they prefer to have their other method, which really, it really has proven itself not to be as effective. But, you know, some people are willing to, you know, sacrifice effectiveness in the name of creativity and interest for kids. Well, anyway, so when Common Core comes along and it has to give teachers one program for what to do with kids, it's not going to really solve that major problem. And so the people who are in charge of Common Core decided not to do the courageous thing that could sink their project, which would have been coming down on the side of research and experience and just wholeheartedly endorsing phonics. But instead, they kind of did a split the baby approach, where they blended both of the methods, and what ended up coming out, you know, was basically ineffective. You know, you're, when you blend something effective with something ineffective, you get, you know, a mediocre pile of garbage. So that's, I mean, so the same thing happened, for example, in math. There's a long-running debate over, you know, whether to have kids learn the basic math operations cold and really memorize things like their multiplication table, their addition facts. And then, you know, there's people who say, you know, that that's boring, it's rote memorization, la, 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 la. So that's kind of, I mean, there's, of course, different smaller camps within both of those broad two sides. But Common Core was actually more dominated in that instance by the sort of people who were against kids learning their math facts and getting down the fundamentals first before moving on to experimental problems. And so what they, you know, again, they basically went largely with a progressive approach to math education that is really frustrating parents and kids and has been ever since Common Core has come into place, you know, between 2010 and 2015. And, you know, it's not having good results for kids. But again, they were faced with a political dilemma of if they did the thing that was effective, then they would turn off a lot of people whose political support they needed in order to get everyone on board with this program.
So tell us a little bit about the results with this first class of high schoolers that went all the way through all 4 years of high school under Common Core in math and reading.
Right. So the Obama administration required states, in exchange for getting back their own education funds, to sign on to Common Core. And that was in 2010, and and the final phasing year was supposed to be 2015. So, of course, we're in 2019, and that means that the kids who graduated this spring are the first class to have been in high school under all 4 years, all high school years of Common Core instruction. The results, quite simply, are not very good. And I mean, before this, the results were not exemplary either. The United States has basically, since we've been comparing ourselves internationally, has never, you know, been in the top tier of advanced nations in terms of student achievement. We're typically around the middle of the pack. So we're going from a mediocre position and taking a step downward in these latest test results. So what ACT found is what has also been found in grade school testing nationwide, which is basically that the gaps between the wealthy kids and the poor kids are particularly growing deeper. But ACT found that, you know, both the math, the reading, the science, and the English scores, that's the four domains that test examines. And in all of those, American kids were down across the bar, with the sole exception being Asian Americans, whose student performance actually improved. And I think that's actually important to note, because it suggests that a lot of people jump on, oh, racism is the explanation for why kids who aren't white can't achieve. And the success of Asians indicates, you know, again, and there's a lot of data on this as well, that it's much more about a combination of home background, the culture, whether your family values education and supports a child in learning, as well as whether that family disposition is also supported by the schools that the kids are going to.
So you quote from U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, where she said the results are frankly devastating. This country is in a student achievement crisis, and over the past decade it has continued to worsen, especially for our most vulnerable students. She seems to understand that there's something wrong. Does the U.S. Education Secretary understand that the problem is Common Core?
I am not sure, because Mrs. DeVos has been very circumspect about her support for Common Core since she joined the Trump administration, which is President Trump opposed Common Core on the campaign trail, although his administration hasn't really done anything about it. Although I'm not really sure there's much that the presidency can do about that. Congress really needs to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education and make it impossible for the federal government to force states into doing what it wants in the realm of education, which is really constitutionally a responsibility of states and localities and families. But before she became a part of the Trump administration, Mrs. DeVos has a record of, her family is very big into charitable giving, and one of the things that they give a lot of money to is Education Enterprises, and their family has given money to support Common Core, particularly in the state of Michigan, where they come from.
So it doesn't look like there's a full realization on the part of the person who's running the organization that sees to it the Common Core is in the classroom of what's really going on here.
Well, and that's pretty typical. And, you know, Common Core, you know, I spent a couple of years writing a book while doing research and reporting on Common Core while it was moving into American schools. And as part of that, I looked at the history of American education. And when you do that, you find out that basically, you know, American public schools have been captive to basically waves of fads that happen about every 8 to 12 years, about every decade. There's some new thing that's supposed to be the silver bullet that will finally, you know, improve American student achievement. And this has been happening since basically the 1950s. So it's the same thing we're seeing right now. We look at student achievement and it is absolutely not where it could be. And it's embarrassing and it's, you know, and it's not good for kids. It's their lives are really being affected by not being able to communicate, by not being able to add, to compute, you know, to achieve at higher levels. Sets them up for success in careers, but also, you know, better communication is better for your personal relationships and makes you better, you know, husband, wife, mother, father, neighbor, and all those sorts of things. So this isn't just, you know, dry statistics here. We're talking about really not doing the best for American kids in the society that we owe to them, that we could. And we know, like I mentioned about the reading and the math, we know how to help American kids achieve more. It's not like it's a great mystery. It's just that ideology and politics, you know, are getting in the way. So, and that's like, you know, like I've been saying, you know, if you look at the history of American education, that has been the story for the past 70 to, you know, 100 years, where we try something that has no track record that, or, you know, its track record is not very good, or the evidence we have suggests it's a bad idea, but it sounds cool and interesting and all the right people get on board and they spend millions, billions, I mean, in the case of Common Core, absolutely billions of dollars and all of these teachers' hours and all of these kids' hours in school putting in a great effort, you know, to, and then we just don't see any results. So I think at this point, it's really clear that the people who come to us with these numbers and tell us that it's a crisis, I mean, I agree with them, but it's also clear that they don't have any idea or any political willpower to do what is necessary in order to actually change the system. It seems that Americans are willing to put up with hearing people clucking their tongues every couple of decades and darting off into some other, you know, reform that doesn't have a good track record and you know, not voting the bums out, so to speak.
Speaking of that, when we come back, Joy Pullman will explain how we already know how to educate our children. We're just not doing it. Stay tuned. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's a monthly magazine on faith and life, theology and culture that helps readers interpret the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective. Filled with expert insights, good writing, and inspiring stories, it also provides essential church information for LCMS members. What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's the flagship periodical of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and it has been for more than a century. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today.
Recently graduated from high school or college and looking for a chance to serve a community in need while sharing the good news of Jesus Christ? Lutheran Young Adult Corps may be for you. Lutheran Young Adult Corps provides opportunities for long-term, full-time service for 10 weeks through the summer or 10 months over the school year in places like St. Louis, Philadelphia, and Boston. Find out more about Lutheran Young Adult Corps by finding us online at lcms.org/YACORPS or on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Lutheran YA Corps.
Lutheranism in the public square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
St. Jacobi Lutheran Church in Shawnee, Wisconsin has a special guest each and every week. It isn't you, but it is Jesus Christ. He is a guest, and he is also the one who comes to serve you with his preached word and his broken body and shed blood. You are invited to be served by Jesus on Saturday evening at 6:30 and Sunday morning at 9 a.m. Visit www.stjakobi.org for more information.
The Holy Trinity addresses three important things for the reader.
Dr. Carl Beckwith talking about his book in the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, The Holy Trinity.
It explains the difficulties we face in confessing the Trinity in our world today. It shows how Scripture carefully and decisively presents the Trinity, and it rehearses the sound pattern of words used by the Church to clarify and defend the witness of Scripture.
Learn more about the Holy Trinity at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com. We're discussing the first Common Core High School graduates with Joy Pullman, author of the book, The Education Invasion. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. You won't find the failed ideas of Common Core in Memoria Press's curriculum. Memoria Press is a classical Christian curriculum publisher. You'll find their resources at memoriapress.com, and you'll save $5 on your next purchase when you use the coupon code LPR20. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time. MEMORIAPress.com. Type in the coupon code LPR20. Joy, I think recently in social media, you responded to some of this hand-wringing about how we're going to educate our children. Someone had posted something saying, you know, what are we going to do about all of this? Your response was simply, we already know how to do this. What do you mean?
Well, like, I mean, I think it was the year 2000, so this is almost 20 years ago, that the U.S. Department of Education, or maybe it was under Ronald Reagan, you know, which would have been 30 years ago, the U.S. Department of Education convened what they called a blue ribbon panel in reading. So these were the nation's top experts, and they exhaustively looked at the research on how to teach kids how to read, and they found the conclusion that I told you, which is that phonics is far and away the most effective way to teach kids how to read, and it reduces dyslexia. It gets kids reading more effectively, efficiently, more quickly. I mean, it's just hands down the winner in methods of teaching kids to read. And basically that report's been ignored by, you know, there's isolated schools, maybe school districts, certainly private schools, homeschoolers who paid attention to that. But the nation as a whole, the nation's public schools, you know, certainly, I mean, again, it's been 30 years, and that was a very authoritative, exhaustive report, you know, included people from all kinds of sides of the political and educational spectrum, and it went nowhere. So, I mean, that's just one example of all kinds of other things. You know, we know how to teach children history. We know how to teach children poetry. You know, we know it's good for them to read good and great literature. This isn't rocket science. It's not like there's some big mystery. You know, any basic parent with common sense, you know, if you say to them, you know, your kids should, you know, learn to read reading phonics. They should read a very strong diet of classic, you know, literature that slowly increases their vocabulary and their knowledge about the world and introduces them to the greatest thoughts ever, you know, said and heard. Same thing in history, where it should be very rich in biographies and memorizing key dates and people and movements, and understanding how those all connect together. And your math and science needs to be, you know, very strongly math-based and, you know, not playing around, but giving the kids a very good, solid foundation where they know their math facts cold, because that's, again, research and experience proves that that's crucial for a higher-level math. If you don't have a solid foundation, you'll never be able to move into algebra, let alone trigonometry and calculus. I mean, again, this isn't, you know, any common person that I've just said that thing to, most people would say, yeah, that makes sense. Isn't that what schools are doing? No, they're not.
I got to wonder whether or not when people look at this or people see these results, why, at least among registered voters, I think you say 52% still believe that their public school is either doing an excellent or good job.
Exactly. So this is another consistent finding, you know, across, so I've been, you know, watching education polls for about a decade now. So it's very typical. The usual is for Americans to say they're worried about the direction of public schools in general, the nation's education system. They have concern about that. They don't think it's as good as it should be. But then you say, okay, what about your local public school? And then their approval of it increases 15 points. They think that their local schools are doing a good job, but the national schools are doing a mediocre or a bad job. And, I mean, those two things can't really be, you know, they're not reconcilable. Like, there's, I mean, either the nation school, you know, one of these things is either false or, you know, either the nation schools are doing better than people think or the local schools are doing worse than people think. But that's really the only way to reconcile those two ideas. But most people don't sit down and think about their cognitive dissonance. And I also, you know, think a lot of people, they just don't know what their local school is teaching kids. They don't know that their school is probably not teaching children Aesop's fables, not teaching them stories from the Bible, not teaching them stories of classic children's literature, but just pulling whatever random thing out of the latest Scholastic catalog. You know, people don't have a very close knowledge of what actually is happening in actual classrooms, what is typical. So they just assume, and they assume a lot better than what is reality.
Then does anybody in a position to make a difference seem to have a reasonable solution to the steady decline of these test scores in reading and math, and then the fact that Common Core has produced a crop of high school students less prepared than any crop of high school students before them for the last 15 years?
I think the only probably palatable political solution that is possible, you know, something that actually could happen, is for a dramatic acceleration in school choice. And so what that means is states need to basically rearrange their education funding systems, which is a big lift, but it's long overdue for an overhaul. We have a very sclerotic, you know, state and national funding systems that really aren't working either for schools or for kids. And what they need to do is attach a certain amount to every single kid in their state and let the family decide where that money goes. My favorite form of that is called education savings accounts. So rather than it just being like a voucher where one lump sum of money goes to a specific school only, there are more options. It's kind of like a health savings account where the state deposits the money for the child. So say actual average state spending on each public school child is about $13,000 a year, but usually you can't get that much for school choice. Usually you can only get half. So say the state puts $5,000 or $6,000 every year into a savings account, and parents are only allowed to use that money for educational expenses. And there are like quality controls on their debit cards, you know, so you can't use the debit card at Walmart. So anyway, then the parents have that money for them every single year, and the money rolls over. So if you don't spend all $5,000 or $6,000 in 2019, you save $1,000. You can use it for next year, and ultimately they can roll it up all the way into being able to use it to pay for college. Anyway, but then the parents can use that money to pay for private school tuition. They can also use it to pay for things. I know a close family friend of ours, your little girl, you know, is in dyslexia therapy, and it's very expensive. This family's paying for it themselves because they love their little girl, you know, but that funding will be allowed to be used for that, you know, because it's obviously an educational expense. Perhaps things like music lessons, sports participation, you know, that sort of thing. So what it does is gives a lot greater freedom for families to kind of customize how their children are being brought up and educated. And that has been actually, it sounds almost like too good to be true, but a number of states have already tried this and it is working really well. And I think more states should do that. And one of the reasons I think it's actually possible is that school choice is hugely popular, you know, when you poll people. In fact, politicians are so far behind where public opinion is on this. And it's one of, you know, a number of things that politicians are really slow, which is kind of confusing to me. But I think it's because politicians actually don't track exactly with voters. They track more with some combination of how tightly voters will let them, are holding the chain from them to basically, they pay much more attention to their campaign donors and special interests than they do to actual voters, unless voters choke the chain and make things like this a voting issue. But, you know, that kind of proposal that I just outlined has public support, you know, between like 60 and 80%, depending on the state and the demographic. It's also hugely popular, you know, again, in the 70s, almost 80% among African Americans and Hispanic families. So it's kind of a political no-brainer there. If politicians would just pay more attention to their voters than they do to teachers' unions, to, you know, public school lobbies, administrators, associations, that sort of thing.
What role do those kind of administrative and union forces play in the promotion of a failing Common Core?
They play a huge, huge role, because basically it justifies their existence, right? I mean, if you need, if American kids aren't healthy and happy and functioning well, if they're not reading, well, you have to hire more reading specialists. You have to hire more consultants. It kind of creates this revolving door of consultancy education bureaucracy that is extremely lucrative for people who manage to get up into it. And then, of course, they have a psychological need, you know, to justify their existence. And so they are very, very invested in how much they believe that they are needed to educate children. So even in states like mine, where the teachers union isn't that strong, in my state, the kind of public school education blob is extremely strong, or even, you know, huge control over even the Republicans in our state, because even, you know, in some of those rural Republican districts, the school district is the largest employer, you know, so kind of that dynamic is what kind of keeps the politicians from responding to what their voters wish they would be doing.
And does that have a bearing on the cost of education too, kind of the administrative cost of education?
Oh, absolutely. There was a great study that was done a couple of years ago by this organization called EdChoice, actually a series of studies. And so one of the things that is just eye-popping, I think, from that is that for every single teacher employed in American public schools, the schools employ one non-teaching employee, you know, so some kind of, again, some kind of curriculum specialist, some kind of, you know, LGBT outreach coordinator, some administrator, some paper pusher somewhere for every single teacher. And, I mean, the study also found, and I'm not going to remember the exact figure, but something like, and it also found that, I think it was since the 1970s, they called it the school staffing surge. The growth in administrative non-teaching staff had, like, quadrupled, or maybe I think it had gone up 400% in that time period. And instead, they calculated if it had just gone up at the same rate as it had been before this kind of explosion in non-teaching staff, teachers could get, for example, I think like a $10,000-$12,000 annual raise, you know, going straight to them, straight to the classroom to attract better people working with kids, higher talent in the classroom, as opposed to being siphoned away to all this sort of administrative bloat. And then there's, of course, all kinds of other ways that money could be used to be more effective for kids. But right now it's being spent on people who don't directly contribute to student achievement.
Joy Pullman is managing editor of The Federalist. She's author of the book, The Education Invasion, and a recent column titled, First Common Core High School Grads Worst Prepared for College in 15 Years. You'll find a link to it under the Talk on Demand archives page at issuesetc.org. Joy, thanks.
Thank you.
Folks, you have 8 hours left to take advantage of dramatically reduced prices during Concordia Publishing House's Fall Warehouse Sale. It ends at midnight central tonight. You can purchase The Reformation by Dr. Cameron McKenzie for $15, Dr. Lewis Brighton's Concordia Popular Commentary on Revelation for $10, and A Year with the Church Fathers by Dr. Scott Murray for $10. Learn more by clicking the CPH Warehouse logo at issuesetc.org. Concordia Publishing House's Fall Warehouse Sale, issuesetc.org. In Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., a tall order for Pastor Brian Wolf Miller. We have been introducing books of the Bible. We have come to one that really does require more than an hour, but I am confident that Pastor Wolf Miller will get us through and introduce us to the book of Romans, headed into the epistles of St. Paul with the big order of Romans next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Have you considered homeschooling your children, but wondered if you have the time or the expertise? If you live in the St. Louis Metro East, check out St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois. we offer a classical Lutheran education for children pre-kindergarten through 8th grade. St. Paul Lutheran School is located just off of Interstate 55 in Hamel. Learn more at school.stpaulhamel.org. St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois. school.stpaulhamel.org.
Do you dread going to work out? Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.